Stolen with me down Petticoat Lane. I fancied this bird, so I asked her her name. Pointed to her husband, 6'2". Oh, what a surprise!
Ding, lad.
Two lovely black eyes.
All together.
Two lovely black eyes.
What is this?
Well,
is it too lovely?
It's actually, there's an interesting story behind this. It's actually, honestly, it was written in 1866, this song, by a Charles Coburn. He was, this was a song about the first gay bar in Harlem.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Two lovely black eyes.
No, oh, no. I totally made that up.
Two black guys.
No.
I don't even think Harlem existed.
Excuse me. Well, I give this guy. Right? Same thing. No, this is Two Lovely Black Eyes. And it was written by Charles Coburn, and it was written in 1886. He was a music hall star in London, or London. This is, of course, the Ermines Ermits of Henry VIII fame and
I believe
Brown.
You mentioned you called them Herman's fucking hermits last time they came up on the show.
Herman's fucking hermits. This is a great
Damn
little
it, Herman's fucking hermits again. Somebody make them stop.
This is their fourth studio album. Most bands like this, Gary Puckett, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders, you go for their greatest hits double album. That way you get all the big ones and stuff. But
yeah.
The B-sides on these old records, like Tommy Rowe records and Herman's Hermits records, are fun. This one's called...
It can be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's Both Sides of Herman's Hermits, and came out in 1966.
All right, let's get cracking then.
Crack is what we do.
Release the Kraken!
Hi, this is Mick Box of Uriah Heep, and you're listening to the Shabby Road Record Show. Keep on rocking.
Well, hey, Labba!
Hey, Labba!
The Shabby Road Record Show is on the air, your hipster-free vinyl podcast. I'm your host, Ryan McKay. And now, if you order within the next 10 minutes, he'll double your order for free. That's right. That's two stories of record label shenanigans, two America not getting it, and two drinking and drugging rock stars from A.D. Adams.
That's right. Well, it's a world of liquor, a world of drugs. It's a world of hookers and hobo thugs. Won't you please come inside, pin your ears open wide. It's a shabby world after all. That's right. Welcome to Disneyland. Welcome to the Disneyland of podcasting, where Dopey, Goofy, and Drunky aren't just the names of beloved characters. They're serious behavioral issues. Welcome to Shabby Road Studio. I got records. Who's drinking?
All right. Let's do this. We got plenty of vinyl.
Plenty of vinyl to share
with you guys tonight. Before we get to that, let's say hi to our good friend over there running the controls in the Shabby Command Center. That's Liz Morgan. What's up, Liz?
I'm resting.
Liz treated us to Uriah Heep concert last night.
How great was that?
so freaking great.
Oh my God. It was great.
God, that was a fun night.
Dude, Mick Box is like a 20-year-old up there.
Yeah.
Laughing and just having a blast rocking. Balls it down. Dude, that band sounded great, and they were not using backup tracks.
No. It was really great to hear the harmonies.
Un-fucking believable.
They had everything working for them.
Dude.
B3 sounded good. I don't know what it was. It wasn't a real B3, but whatever he was using.
Yeah.
Sounded pretty darn good at that, volume.
It's kind of cool. We dorked out a couple times and yelled Bird of Prey.
We did.
And Mick Box kissed
Circle
me.
Of Heads. Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. What's this now?
You got a smooch from
Say that again.
I got a smooch from Mick Box.
He kissed you.
Yes, he did.
And then he kissed me.
Oh.
He saw me sitting on the couch waiting for Mark to finish.
Uh-huh.
He's like, I'm like,
finish what? Well, what's going on back there?
Back it up.
Right, yeah. I'll hold the camera.
I'm like, Mick Box, you rock. And he's like, come here, darling, give me some sugar.
Ooh,
Woo.
Then Mick Box got two lovely black eyes.
From Mark.
Two lovely black eyes. He kissed me, girl, and now I poked his face. Too long back.
Thanks to everybody at BLK Live in Scottsdale for that. That was really fun.
Yeah.
VIP treatment all the way for our shabby guys. We're not used to that.
No, we're usually being collared and dragged out. Right. Going, dude, I swear, it wasn't me.
So if you're going to, if Uriah Heep is coming to your town, go.
Yeah, man, yes. Seriously, go.
All right, well, let's give a shout out to our friends over at nameonanything.com, AD.
Oh, nameonanything.com. If you want recognition in any business, there is one surefire way to get there, but there are some ways that will help you to move your career forward. One is to get on your knees and work for it, sailor boy. Another one is to toil hard every day, honing your craft until you made a name for yourself. But if you don't like having men milk mustaches, or if you have an aversion to actual effort of any kind, you can always get famous by simply plastering your fucking name everywhere. Put your name or logo in every possible location on the damn planet. Put it on a dirigible over Detroit. Put it on a billboard in Biloxi. Put it on a lampshade in London. Who can do that for you, Ryan?
NameOnAnything.com.
T-shirts, stickers, caps, mugs, and so much more. NameOnAnything.com. NameOnAnything.com.
Save 10% when you mention Shabby Road Record Show when you put your order together. Great people over there. We love it. Mm-hmm. We love those people.
That's a big savings.
They just did a bunch of stuff for Seven Dust.
I am winded.
Oh, cool.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, they did Seven Dust.
They
right?
did. As a matter of fact, Seven Dust is opening their tour right here in sunny Phoenix, Arizona, and their merch was printed and sent to them in Canada, and it's caught up in customs.
Yep.
And so I was talking to Steve, and he said he had to find an Arizona printer to make it happen. So no matter what the situation, they got you covered over at nameonanything.com.
Go, man.
Yeah,
go.
Problem solved.
Right?
Yeah. Steve's on the case.
Yeah, your shirts will be at the big gig, Nigel.
So, all right, we got some records to get going here for us. So
we do.
Let's start cracking these open.
Well, let's crack them open. What do you got?
Wait,
you got anything
you wanna
good?
Say hello to anybody else?
Oh, Sal 5000. We forgot Sal again. We get to talking about Heap. How are you doing, Sally? I'm sorry for not introducing you.
Kiss my ass, sugar.
Mm-mm. I deserve every bit of that.
And there we go.
There she is.
Off to a start
that
now.
That bag of bolts.
We've riled her.
Yes. Yep. So Liz has the two playing cards. We're going to see who's going to go first. Who's going to be the first one to throw some records down. And while she's doing that, how's your box looking? Give me a couple sentences about the whole thing.
Well, I got a first timer on the show. Two of them, as a matter of fact, oddly enough. We've never played these Saudi gits ever on here. Some fucking punks from London, 1978.
Nice.
Yes. What do you got?
Nice. My box is from another listener. This is the last one. All of April here. I've been doing listener-supported boxes. They've chosen from my record collection on Discogs. And this week, we're wrapping it up with Jens Hellberg.
Okay.
He has chosen three very eclectic records.
Okay.
Who I believe, let's see, two of the three have not been on the show. Actually, all three, but I'm really not sure about one because I swear you've brought them once before. It might have been on Who Did It Better, but it's all new stuff, really, for the show proper.
Oh, good.
Yeah. That's
think,
all I'll say.
I think, right?
We may box. We're going to need to do an 8-ball of Coke to get through the last one.
I'm looking forward to that. I'll stay up.
I know one that is.
You know. Okay, so that's the one Liz knows. Okay.
I have another first-timer from New York City, 1968. Dude, you guys, the highest, most stonery band we've ever played here. They're so high.
Monarch.
They made us look like amateurs. These guys are so high. We've played 13th Floor Elevator, some of those old 60s psychedelic bands that you couldn't write. Mm-hmm. These guys are totally more high than them.
Okay, wow. And anything else? Is that all of them?
I got one more.
What do you got?
I got a classic Shabby and Yes, a Supergroup. Heavy, LA, California, 1972.
All right, well, let's get these going.
Supergroup.
I guess I'll pick this week the cards. Let's go right hand, not a supergroup AD. I guarantee it's not.
I think, okay.
Who is it?
Red
AD. You're going first. All right, what you got, brother?
Well, I've got something fun right off the bat.
That means we're doing coke at the end of the show.
Yeah, right?
Good.
No, you know what? We haven't had this group in here before. It's quite amazing. This is embarrassing, but I don't believe that we've ever had The Clash on here, have
yes,
we?
Yes, we have.
Have we?
I played them. Combat Rock. I played track on side one. What's it called? I forget. Kurt sent me Combat Rock, and I brought it.
Oh, that's right. You know what? That somehow didn't make the archives. I looked them up and cross-referenced in the archives. I'm going to have to correct that. Maybe that's on my archives, though. I'll have to check. I'll
have
to check the other one.
It was recent. You may be looking at an older
Or it may not have updated mine proper from the other one. I'll have to look on the other one that Steve did. So, yeah. But yeah, anyway. Yeah. Oh, okay. Then it's not a first-timer. So that's equally as embarrassing.
Not a virgin. Think about that.
Right. Yeah. No, this is their second album, Give Enough Rope.
Yes. And that's a classic.
This is, you know what? There's a lot of people, like probably even me, like this album. I like the first album, you know? Yeah. I think they found a proper fit between just too raw, punky on the first record, which the first record's
Punky
great.
Meadows.
But this is a little bit.
This is
a little bit more, studio polished, and it's interesting who produced this album. Are you familiar with who produced this?
Oh,
right?
I forget.
Sandy Pearlman.
Oh, New York guy. He best known for Blue Oyster Cult.
Blue Oyster Cult, like the sixth oyster, if you will.
Yes.
The sixth oyster in the.
I love that bar in Manhattan.
Right, the sixth oyster.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome to the sixth oyster.
It's great seafood.
What are you gonna have here?
That funny smelling one.
Yeah.
Ooh, I went there with two lovely black guys earlier.
So, it's interesting how this works. You know, again, the USA versus UK release thing, right?
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Different
right?
track listing or whatever?
Yeah. So, different track listing, different covers. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. Their debut LP, The Clash, self titled, it was released in April of 77, right? So, over in the UK, it wasn't released in the US.
Mm.
So, that one, you know, that kind of the pistols were happening, you know, it was 77 hit. So, there was a punk scene in London.
Sure.
So this is their second record, and it came out really strong.
Mm-hmm.
It did actually better than their first record initially. So on the strength of that, the label, Epic, who is distributed by CES, CBS says, well, look, we'll put these guys out in the States. We'll put their second record out. So the first, this record, their second that I have in my hand, was the first record released in the United States. This was released in 78. In the UK, and simultaneously then came out in the United States as their first album.
Oh, interesting. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah, pretty trippy. So, and then then they released the first record the following year in 79.
Hmm.
So the Clash was released as the second album in the US.
It's backwards.
Right, yeah.
It's tether way round.
But it's kind of weird. It is. It are, aren't it?
It,
it am, amn't it?
Yes.
But it's kind of cool, though. It's one of those weird little, I don't know if it's fuck-ups or opportunity or whatever you want to call it, whatever the scenario is. It actually played out pretty well for them, because what happened is this came out strong. It had some backing by the label, and they went, oh, okay, well, then we'll push it in the United States, which they didn't even release their first record. So if their first record had died, this probably wouldn't have seen the light of day in the U.S.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It would have had a weak showing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool for the Clash that happened. So then all of a sudden the label's going, well, second record's selling, let's push it. They push it, it hits the charts. It wasn't top 100 maybe-ish, but it charted for a punk record, which was pretty unprecedented.
Yeah.
And so on its popularity, then they brought the first record in, and people are going, oh yeah, the Clash, fuck yeah.
Yeah, you know? My new favorite band.
Right, so then it sold. And then, of course, the year after that, London Calling came out, and the Clash
and
had arrived,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it was kind of this weird strategy. I don't know if it's, I mean.
Not planned, probably.
Not planned. I mean, whatever happened because that's what they wanted to do, but I don't think they could have written it better, the result better. Because don't forget then, in 1980, London Calling came out in 79. So they put this, the first and the, so then MTV's coming along, and who better, you know, they need visuals. Well, look at these guys. They're punks. Punk's kind of still cool.
Yeah.
You know,
and they transitioned out of punk very well with London Calling and into Sandinista and combat rock.
And that was a big deal. That caused a big rift between Mick Jones and Joe Strummer. They were kind of going in different directions at the time.
Yeah.
And so, and meanwhile, you know, Topper Heaton, he's you mentioned Sandinista. Combat rock was the last one that Topper Heaton played on, and he was just fucked up on heroin.
Yeah.
So they had gotten all that stuff, but they had gotten a lot more pop, a lot more reggae, definitely
dub.
Definitely, yeah. Strummer was frustrated. He wanted harder stuff, You know, Mick Jones was doing all the dubby stuff, and he ended up doing the big Audio Dynamite thing.
Yeah.
Which was very dub. He still had, you know, he still had the trademark telly thing going.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, but so shit blew up. You know, finally, the Clash, this was 86, I think. And the Clash was playing at the US Festival.
Okay.
And they had somehow gotten in a physical altercation with the promoters prior to the show about, you know, donating X amount of the, you're going to donate so much money to this charity. And the promoter said, well, no, we're not.
I'm here to make money.
Yeah.
I'm an impresario.
So there was a big row went down. And so they played.
And it got physical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So then, and there was like 140,000 people there. So these guys are at the top of their game and just pissed. Hating each other, you know, they can't find a drummer, like, fucking, you know, dude's on heroin, they went to another guy and he was okay, and they got another guy and he was okay, and, like, God damn it, you know? And so after the show, same show, I guess there was a big, like, near riot with the Clash guys and the security there. So there was a big fisticuff, you know, like the comic book thing where there's a big cloud of dust and you see a fist coming out.
Nice, Sally. It was right as you were doing a punch,
I did. That
too.
Was, the timing was perfect. My fist went in the air. It was like, that was like a kung fu movie. That was very well done. You weren't even looking, were you? That's fucking awesome. What are the odds of that? So, yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, it was like one of those things where it's just like, but they got huge. They got lucky. I think the whole thing, the way it played out, it went well. You know, I don't think they'd have seen the light of day. I don't think that second album would have been released, or definitely would not have been pushed to the point where the actual first album was pushed as the second album, if that made any sense at all. Right? You follow me?
Yeah, way it worked out.
Yeah, so, you know, that's kind of a... So they broke up. That after that show, Mick Jones went, I shan't be doing this anymore. And he just went, did Big Audio Dynamite, and Joe Strummer drank a lot. You know?
Yeah, and they never got back together,
No, they never got back together, man. They just, they're like, fuck it.
Not in earnest. Maybe they appeared together on something, maybe. I don't even know if they did that.
No. So it's interesting. So, yeah, but, you know, it's cool. A real quick story about Joe Strummer. I just got to tell a personal story with the Glass Heroes for years after his death in 2002.
Your band, the Glass Heroes.
Yeah, my old band, the Glass Heroes. We did the Joe. Keith was actually friends with Joe Strummer, made friends with
That's
him.
That's right. And the that singer for his, Glass Heroes, Keith Jackson.
That was his idol, you know. And so he got to meet him, and they got to be friends. It was pretty cool.
Very cool.
One of those things, you know. And there's actually a cool picture of the two of them sitting down on a curb, and both are smoking a cigarette. And it's almost like two of the exact people. They're in the exact same position, you know, smoking, holding the cigarette the same. Their hair is this, it's pretty cool fucking picture, man. It's really about it. So anyway, we every year after his death, Joe Strummer still has the Joe Strummer Memorial. I'm sorry, the Joe Strummer Foundation or Strummerville charity. And they give money to aspiring musicians and stuff. So we did that for 8 years and raised a lot of money for Lucinda, his wife, and that foundation. So I'm kind of proud of that.
That's
actually
very cool.
Something we were doing. So, you know, we raised a lot of money for them. Wait, what were we thinking? They're giving money to upcoming musicians.
Yeah.
What
did you
are
get
we?
A cut? Did you get a cut?
We should have just done the show and kept the money. Hey,
you've
look,
been upcoming for 40 years.
Your foundation is fantastic. You know? So anyways, you know, it's just, I was kind of proud of that. That was kind of one of those cool things. And you know, Keith Jackson, you know, him being, you know, his favorite rocker of all time is Joe Strummer. And it was kind of cool that he was able to connect with him and his widow on that stuff. So kind of cool. So I'm going to play from
Tommy Gunn?
Yeah, I'm going to play Tommy
Are
Gunn.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, I guessed it. I love that song. Yeah. It's the best track on the record.
It's a song about hijacking and Middle Eastern terrorism.
Okay.
As the Clash are wont to do.
All right.
Right?
Oh, come on.
How powerful are they?
Right?
Jesus.
Anyone want to fight a bomb something? Come on.
Oh, my God.
The Clashes. That's the Clashes. And Give Enough Rope out by the Clash. Tommy Gunn, of course, 1978 release. So this is indeed the second time.
Second
time. The Clash has been spun here on this little Uncle Fester of a show here.
All right. Well, moving on.
Yes, move on.
Jens Hellberg, thank you very much for making these selections tonight for my mystery box. This is going to be fun. I got some interesting things going on in here. One of the things that Jen said when I reached out to him and told him that I had chosen his selections, he said he went for stuff that I think hasn't been played on the show, and I thought you could probably dig up some fun stories.
Some Burl Ives, perhaps.
That's in a little piece of what he said. I'll come back to him a little later because he does make mention of my last pick.
Yes.
Liz knows it.
I do.
So I'm going to change up my order.
What's going on around here?
So this is a band. Now, this is another controversy. Is like, have these guys been played on the show before?
Apparently, I don't know.
This is one of your favorite all-time bands. So it shocks me that you haven't brought them.
Marnock?
No, they're not up there on the list.
And it certainly has one of your favorite singers in the man named Levi Stubbs.
Oh, the Ooh. Four motherfucking tops. Are you
the
kidding?
Four tops. Greatest Hits is what
they
I brought.
They haven't been played on here?
According to the archive, no. But so
Shame
I'm thinking maybe we did maybe we did it on a Who Did It Better or something.
I can't believe
we've
that.
We've talked about your passion for
I fucking love
the
it.
Four
they're
tops.
Just my favorite of all the Motown artists. They're my they're at the top of the list, man. They're number
at
one.
The top.
Number
No pun intended.
Four tops. I don't really.
That's what it says.
I can't believe that.
I know. I was shocked.
I'm embarrassed.
So I'm going to play Bernadette.
Oh.
Because Bernadette.
Oh.
Another one of their string of hits from the 1960s. This is released in 1967. In February of 1967 is Bernadette. This is a greatest hits album that were all issued with similar covers. Like you can find a Temptations album that has that same cover. Probably the
Martha
and the Vandellas, yeah. You know, Supremes.
Yep. Marvin and the Gays.
Marvin and the, wow. And they all came out in 1967. And Bernadette's written by, of course, Holland Dozier Holland. Features the backing band, of course, of the Frunk Brothers. And it was, of course, recorded at the legendary Hittsville, USA building in Detroit, Michigan. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, right?
It's everything. This album
magic.
Is... magic. This album is... everyone needs to have this album. Right?
Yeah. The Four Tops are something. I mean, you know, Motown. But Levi Stubbs can sell a fucking song, man.
Mm-hmm.
You hear him and his voice is so passionate. And when Levi Stubbs loves you, he loves you.
Yes,
and
he does.
When Levi Stubbs is sad, dude, he's so...
You know what it is?
Sad.
I was doing some research and I came across somewhere it was posted that Holland, Dozier Holland, who wrote and produced these songs, they knew his voice was not a tenor. It was more of a baritone voice. And they wrote it specifically, all these melodies at the top of his
throaty,
at the top of his range, every one of them, because they loved how when he get up there, it got big and it got emotional.
Hey, Holland, I wrote a new song. What's it go like, Dozier? I don't know, but it's going to hurt that motherfucker's neck.
Let's kill this guy.
It's going to hurt his fucking neck.
So they were founded as the Four Ames after performing together at high school for one of their friends' birthday parties. That's how the four guys got together.
Oh, no kidding.
The aforementioned Levi Stubbs. You got Duke Fakir. Is it Fakir?
Fakir.
Fakir.
Liz. How dare you? Too soon.
Oh,
actually, he's still alive. Obi Benson and Lawrence Payton were the four tops. And they worked together for four decades, man, until they started dropping like flies. They stayed together until 1997 when one of them passed away. I think it was... whoever went first, it was Lawrence Payton, maybe.
Okay,
died.
You're a top, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you're a top.
Okay.
Money's good still.
Yeah,
still
you can
playing
do those
you on,
package tours even in the 90s.
Yep, the fucking oldie stations are still playing you all across America. There's probably two oldie stations in every major city playing your stuff every day.
It's the same old song, but it's fun.
You going to quit?
No.
Hell no, I'm not going to quit.
I'm a top.
I'm a top. I'm in. I'm a top.
Yeah. So it was a huge string of hits. You know, once they hooked up with Holland Dozier Holland over there at Motown,
oh, man.
Then it became, I mean, Reach Out, I'll Be There was huge.
Sugar Pie Honey, but yeah, I mean, come on.
Same old song. Yeah, it's just one after the next. But then, of course, Motown, Berry Gordy picks up because he wants to get into the film industry out in Hollywood. He packs up.
Moves it, yeah.
And they move to L.A. But the Four Tops were one of just a couple of the artists on the roster that stayed in Detroit. They're like, you go, and we'll go somewhere else. And they hooked up with ABC Dunhill later on. And then they ended up, I believe, even Casablanca or somebody had him later or something weird.
So. How awesome is that?
All right.
Them and Long John Baldry and Gene Simmons and George Clinton just getting high cocaine. Oh, what a party. Donna Summer.
Cocaine!
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know if you know this story. In December of 1988.
Oh, yeah, I know that story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pan Am Flight 103 became the group's scheduled return flight to the U.S.
No shit.
For Christmas. So they're after completing their European tour. So they're over there in England, and
the Lockerbie bombing?
They want to get back. Mm-hmm. They want to get back to the States. A prolonged recording session and a performance at the television show Top of the Pops caused them to oversleep. All Four Tops.
Oh.
I imagine the Four Tops in one bed, you know, with stocking caps and
like the
bunk beds. And they all, one rolls over, they all roll over like the Stooges. Yeah.
So they ended up missing their flight, and of course, Pan Am Flight 103 crashed in Lockerbie, Scotland, after a terrorist bomb was detonated on board.
Holy shit.
Would have took out every top.
Every last top.
From top to bottom.
Holy shit.
Nice, Liz. And with that, we will drop the needle.
She needs rest.
We will drop the needle on the other top 10 hit that they had in 1967. This is the huge voices, Levi Stubbs. This is Bernadette.
This may be my favorite.
It's awesome.
All right.
You can hear them doing sort of the minor key stuff like they used in Reach Out, I'll Be There. You know, it's sort of a rewrite. Still Holland Dozier Holland, who wrote the Reach Out song, too.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear this thing.
Oh, come on.
Oh!
Oh, I'll never get tired of that song, man.
Dude.
It's so great. That voice right at the edge of breaking every time, like right at the edge.
I mean, you know what? He sounds like, I mean, he would, you fuck with Bernadette, he will fight you. He will fuck you up.
He will hurt you bad.
Oh, that voice, that passion in his voice is just like, oh my God, it's so compelling.
I know, right?
Oh my God.
Oh, great song. Yeah. 67 Motown Records, obviously.
Jens, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right, what you got, man?
All right, I got.
What are you doing?
I got a box full of guys right here. Can you see the smoke?
Box
full of guys, full of guys, full of guys.
Oh, another Beyonce number.
Yes.
Oh, from the upcoming album, The Box by Beyonce.
The box.
Box full of guys.
Yes.
I got a box full of guys, full of guys, full of guys.
I got a box. I'm surprised there's not smoke billowing out of this box.
Why, is it Kiss?
I got a box full of guys right here who make Cheech and Chong look like choir boys.
Oh.
Really?
Not smoke machine, but smoke as in...
Snoop
weed.
Dogg.
So
Snoop Dogg
is effing, no. Snoop Dogg is puffing on his first dube. These guys, Frankie Carretta, Mike Lasando, Johnny Vancho, and Al Petrucci, a nice bunch of Jewish kids from New York. Yeah.
What do you got over there?
All right, we have another first timer, and I'm talking, dude. I swear to God, these guys.
Who is it?
The Tea Company. Come and have some tea.
It's the Tea Company.
With the Tea Company.
Where did you find this and why did you buy it?
This is a Mott, well, this is Mott Collection one.
Oh, it's a Mott Collection.
Now, check this out.
Let me see this.
There's so many. This came out in, what, 1968?
68, 67,
yeah,
I was going to say,
Smash,
just by the look of it.
Yeah, Smash Records. The album is called Come and Have Some Tea with the Tea Company.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, 1968. You got that flipped over?
Mm-hmm.
Ryan, why don't you read from the top of the back of the record there? Just kind of read down the first few paragraphs there. And...
Just your cup of tea. The brisk, enjoyable Tea Company. Blending here only their choicest cuts. Relax with the company of tea. Morning, noon, and night. Let your head become a... flow through sound bag. It gives you
a sound bag.
It gives you solid sound swifter. A pour fresh bubbling Tea Company on a full volume phonograph. B bring head to a boil. C steep as long as preferred. Okay.
These guys are
all right.
Oh, man, right? Hi, it's Rick James. So, yeah, let me see that thing real quick. Cause there's
you want
some
it back?
Stuff under, yeah, just I want to... So, yeah, I mean, that's... you can see all the you know, obviously tea marijuana references on here. And they got leaves, you know, that are actually tea leaves, but they make it look like sort of the government, this is cannabis type, warning type thing. So there's a concept behind it and everything. And track... track two on side two.
Uh-huh.
It's minute 39. It's called Don't Make Waves, and in parentheses, water sound effects. It's pretty much 1 minute and 39 seconds of multi-track dudes doing bongs, like bong water.
No way.
Wow.
Yeah, I kid you not. Ryan, listen, seriously, there's complexity of tonal tapestry, the Barry tenor and alto soprano bongs combined with the tape speed wizardry and echo plexes bring a sense of wonder to the listener.
Oh, I can't hardly wait to experience this
it's
aurally.
It's deep. Yes, it's deep, man. It's like deep and like, you know, you won't get it unless you're like turned on, man.
Well, there's nothing like experimenting.
That's right.
So, I mean,
Sally.
The flowers thing. Now, it's funny you mentioned that because I was going to play that one. That's the highest song I've ever heard.
And longtime listeners of the show are going, no way.
Because
we played some
you guys,
high shit.
Listen to me out there, whoever's listening. Telling you. But you know why I couldn't play it?
Why? It's too long.
Supper's ready rule.
I noticed there's only three tracks on side one.
10 minutes and 8 seconds.
A little over the mark.
You know what I was going to do? Just pick up the needle and last like 10 seconds. I would go, there you go. But that doesn't count, I guess. That would kind of be cheating. But yeah, that's a really high one. Another one, actually, this is their one and only record.
They got too high to make a second.
I think they forgot they had a band. You know, they're still, yeah. You know, they're still looking for other players. I mean, you got a drummer. No, you're the drummer. All right.
I thought I was the guitar player.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
And they're eating chips. So I was going to also, you know, where do you start? Side one, track one.
Do they have any pop sensibility at
no,
all?
No. And it's amazing.
Okay. Wow.
It's amazing.
No, they're smoking there's, bongs.
I totally found this like sort of review bio thing on them. And it was just like, what did they say that, you know, that they were Beatle, that they had claimed their Beatle references. And I'm like, no fucking way. This album has nothing to do with even the most fucked up of Beatles. Even like Revolution 9,
yeah,
is like a pop hit compared to
it's Bernadette.
I'm telling you, these guys, which makes me love this album.
Of course you do.
it's pretty cool, man. So
maybe they meant the Beatles in reference to the way that they were while they were recording.
Maybe.
Ooh, could be.
They could just. In the sense that Beatles, not invented, but were certainly pioneers in psychedelia.
Right, yeah. But, I mean, this is just, I don't know. Somebody paid for them. Somebody paid for the studio time. That's
drums,
all I'm saying.
Bass, guitar.
Yeah, you know, vocals, and the kind of synthy, like, you know, organ? 60s organ-y thing.
Farfisa? So,
yeah, just, yeah, kind of Farfisa, you know, okay. cheap, like, you know, Vox organ.
Yeah.
Crappy guitar fuzz box.
Yeah.
You know, probably okay. a fuzz face or a big muff.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Another one of the Beyoncé's songs.
Yeah, big muff. Big muff. Right? So, listen, seriously, if you're listening at home right now, or if you're in your car on your way to work, load up that 4-foot bamboo bong and take a huge hit
of tea.
And then hold it in until the vocals start on this track. Good shit, huh? Who's your pal? Yeah. Who's your pal?
It reminds me of our buddy Germ, yeah. who could say a complete paragraph while holding in a...
He could recite the Gettysburg Address.
You guys need to fucking get that distortion pedal on the guitar, then put the pan it left, and then get it pan right, and then...
Fuck yeah, Germ. So anyway, I'm going to dedicate this to Germ.
Yeah.
The Tea Company. Come and have some tea with the Tea Company. I'm going to play... you guys, this is great. This is called Love Could Make the World Go Round. The funny thing is, he starts off like full of love and hope for mankind and brotherhood and understanding. And tell me if it's me. Tell me if I'm wrong. But halfway through the song, he's about ready to fucking fight you.
He so, forgot about
yeah,
that.
I forgot about the love. So tell me if I'm wrong. Like, take. I don't know. Whatever. These guys are fake.
Looking at most people to find there's something missing in their life, to live for themselves, society's judgment, why war and politics must go on in life. They call us hippies who talk for peace and peace of mind, just trying to find why life goes on, just stealing away, just stealing away what is right. Yeah. what was missing in their lives. Lincoln, McCartney, and Lennon. Yes, even Bob Dylan put up a good fight. Away with them, says society. 'Cause you know, they just don't dress right. People of love find no peace of mind in using their fists just to fight. If we trip and expand our minds, you call our flights just a fantasy. But actually, in our society, we find reality. To the people of society, just listen to where it's at. Maybe you'll find your peace of mind by heeding how we act.
There you go.
Are we still on?
There you go. He passed out there.
Ooh, I drifted away.
Hey, don't spill the bong water, Ryan.
Wow.
The tea company. Now, I was saying earlier, and I think I stopped. I think I wandered off, is that I was going to play side one, track one, but it just wandered off. It just went nowhere. There was no hook. It just went nowhere. It was nowhere for it to go. Let me just say this for the record. This was the most focused song on the album.
That was?
They were digging in. They were going deep in this one. They were really fucking cerebral.
Squirrel. Lincoln, Lennon, and McCartney.
And
why is Lincoln mixed up in
and
that?
And sure, Bob Dylan sure put up a fight somehow. Oh. All of a sudden, Bob Dylan's duking it out. They're talking about peace and love. So that was the tea company. I don't know if you guys got a contact high from that. I know I'm baked.
Wow.
I know I am just baked. Tea Company, 1968, Smash Records. Frankie Coretta wrote that, and Joseph Cosentino produced it. So, yeah, the tea company.
There they go. Wow.
Body.
Woo-wee. That was some high stuff.
I need some Doritos.
I need some Visine.
Well, right? let's right this ship and play something that's very well produced and very well executed.
Excellent.
One of the records that Jens wanted to hear was another band that we haven't played on the show before. And I'm speaking of the Alan Parsons Project.
Oh, my God. Yeah, okay.
So I brought the first album, which is, of course, a concept album based around poems and short stories by the great Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, that's in honor, right. Tales of Mystery Imagination.
In honor of us seeing Heap last night.
Yeah. Oh.
Heap and Poe are together again.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's right.
All right. And if you haven't listened to our show that we do, Happy Hour, it's in your feed alongside the regular episodes. Happy Hour is always fun, and that's one of the games we play.
Yes, it is.
Heap or Poe, where you have to guess the lyric or poem.
This is a Uriah Heap tribute album, then.
I guess. Yes. Yeah, that would have been funny if Alan Parsons would have done, like, a cover of The Wizard by Uriah Heap on here.
Yeah.
So,
you.
So this is a cool package. Now, this one, if you're going to the record store and you're looking to pick up some Alan Parsons, first of all, I'd tell you just buy the first two. This one and iRobot.
Yeah.
iRobot's good. But then after that, it's like, I don't know. It's too clean. The problem with Alan Parsons Project is, like, when they try to rock, it doesn't feel like they're rocking.
It gets, like, drony.
It rocks like like a Richard Marx trying to rock, you know, where it's just like, I'm not buying the rock.
You
know?
Ouch.
It's too clean. It's
if
too good.
If I were Alan Parsons, I would hunt you down and punch you for that.
No kidding.
But these records are produced quite well.
Well, it's they just, are. They
just don't try to rock. I don't like you if you're trying to rock, really.
Don't do it. Yeah, don't like do that Michael if you Bolton. Can't.
Right.
Like, yeah, Michael Bolton rocking.
But
yeah.
There's two different versions, two different covers, and what you want to do is get the green one, because when you open it up, it's got a really nice booklet inside that's attached in a gatefold, which gives you little short stories and gives you kind of all the lyrics and
useless bits of information.
Yes, useless bits.
That's
plus, you get a whole timeline of Edgar Allan Poe's life, which I read through. It's
get out of here.
Very interesting, and I'll cover a few of these.
So he wrote Demons and Wizards in 1849?
The Rainbow Demon was written in 18...
Sitting on a park bench just before he died.
Bird of Prey. No, I shall call it the Raven instead.
From Edgar Allan Poe, this one's called Easy Living. Okay, so we're going to hear a song called The System of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather. And the full name of this is Alan Parsons Project from the album Tales of Mystery and Imagination. 1976, this record comes out on 20th Century Records. Now, so every song on this record, you got The Raven is one of the songs. Telltale Heart is one of the songs.
Nevermore.
And side two has Pit and the Pendulum, which is all instrumental, but it's orchestrated and it's quite
good. I had a movie called
good.
The Tit and the Pendulum.
Have you now?
Oh, yes.
Who is that the one you did with Anna?
Anna
Nethercock.
yes.
She was great.
Fine actress, yes.
She was up for anything.
Yes.
So, where do we start? Let's start with, we'll talk about...
I'm going to throw up. I'm throwing up. You're making me throw up, Ryan.
Okay. Let's start with Alan Parsons Project here. I got a couple paragraphs about Poe and Parsons and the story itself of what it's based on, what this particular track is based on. So, Parsons and his sidekick, Eric Wolfson, and sidekick is probably not the right word for him because they are partners. Like, he was an older, like, Eric Wolfson was a producer and arranger and songwriter older than Parsons. But they met when they were working, they were both working at Abbey Road, and apparently there's some sort of a bar at Abbey Road, and they kind of hit it off there.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Let's go right around the pub and have a pint.
Right.
In the summer of 1974. And Parsons had already acted as... Parsons had already done some Beatles records, of course. That's where he gets his start, right. At Abbey Road in 1969. He did that record, and he also worked on Let It Be.
I believe he was the Walrus.
The walrus was Paul.
Dang.
He engineered the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon album in 73.
He did.
And he produced several acts for EMI Records. And Wolfson, his sidekick here, a songwriter and composer, was working as a session piano player. He'd also composed material for a concept album. This thing's all based on Edgar Allan Poe. So this idea is actually Eric Wolfson's.
Oh, brilliant.
So when Parsons asked Wolfson to become his manager, then he accepted and subsequently managed Parsons' career as a producer and engineer through a string of albums. So he's basically looking like, can you be my manager and get me more production work? Both of these guys do not want to be in the spotlight. Matter of fact, Alan Parsons Project never played live for decades.
Yeah,
you're not
going to make any money doing that. We know that.
Right. So,
I mean,
I guess. So in the 70s, he does, you know, the band Pilot. Was their hit Magic? Oh, it's Magic.
Yes, I think so.
Oh, my friend Kevin Kelly. Oh, it's Magic.
My Dick?
My Dick, yes.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
We were in high school.
He did the Cockney Rebel, Steve Harley stuff, Al Stewart. Big difference.
Oh, jeez.
Ambrosia.
Oh, love Ambrosia.
Yeah. All those records sound super clean, right? And so Parsons commented at the time that he felt frustrated having to accommodate some of the views of the musicians, and he kind of felt it interfered with his production, his one vision. And so,
how dare you bring your song into my production?
It's sort of Bob Ezrin-y school yeah. of like, it's when you get a Bob Ezrin produced record, it sounds like a Bob Ezrin record. Alan Parsons productions, same thing. Wolfson and him hatched this idea. Wolfson sort of putting it towards, or at least putting it in, framing the conversation in film where directors like Stanley Kubrick have style.
Yeah, right.
Hitchcock. And he sees music sort of moving towards that. So those guys in the 70s are working as producers, basically forming their own sound and working with bands and having a complete reign of terror over the band, going, you will sound like Alan Parsons.
Yeah, so you come in, I've written a song.
Okay.
And it becomes a fucking symphony.
Right. where did you find a tiniest little piano?
It's on my phone.
Tiniest little piano.
Look at that.
Look at that. Okay, that's enough.
That was good, Alan. What are you going to make?
That's pretty good, yeah. I'll make a song out of that.
Do something with that.
So, of course, Alan Parsons Project did a lot. I'm taking that away from you.
Every time you say Alan Parsons.
Alan Parsons. It's got to be the same.
Music for cats.
So they released several successful albums in North America. Interestingly enough, they're not big in the UK. So for our UK listeners,
really?
They're like, who are you playing?
Wow.
They had like some minor stuff. Nothing real big, you know? So,
well, they weren't the Beatles.
I don't know where you're at with Alan Parsons. Are you
hit or miss?
It is definitely hit or miss.
I'll take him. I'll serve it. I'll take it as he serves it up. You know, I'm not going to go, yeah, I'm all in, or I'm not going to reject him, because he's got some stuff that I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah, totally. And this, it's all session players. The aforementioned Pilot Band are the guys that are on this album.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You can't, you know, that's like one of those Steely Dan things. You could always get trapped in that argument. Well, they're not very good. And you go, well, they are good. You know, I just don't like them. You know? So you can get trapped into that. But, you know, so that they're, Alan Parsons is one of those bands, I think.
Yeah. The first two records are good.
Oops. I mean, Alan Parsons is one of those bands.
Yes,
sorry.
You got
shit.
A little piano over there.
Damn it.
Hey, I do the sound effects.
Hey.
So let's talk about the song, and then we'll drop the needle.
I point my phone at you.
Let's talk about the song,
okay,
and then
sorry,
when we come back.
Ryan's trying to work over there.
I'm working over here. Come on.
I know.
When we come back after the song, we'll talk a little bit about Poe, because I got some of those talking points from actually the record and then some other stuff, you know, his life, which was fascinating.
Oh, the laudanum.
The System of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather by Alan Parsons, or actually by Edgar Allan Poe, rather. An unnamed narrator visits a mental institution, much like I come here every Monday night.
Right.
He is intrigued by the system of soothing.
They turned me loose from the nervous hospital. Said I'd well. Mm-hmm.
Sally. Sally hates me tonight.
Yeah.
So he isn't. There's a new system that he's going to investigate that's supposedly doing very well, a system of soothing. And the caretakers of this particular mental hospital have implemented it. Now, the narrator is then treated to a large dinner party where he meets the caretakers of the institution. But this party is like a really strange party. It features people decked out in jewelry and fancy clothes, candles everywhere, like wherever you can stick a candle, it's there.
Oh,
and
hey,
it's lit.
Oh, hey there, Jim.
It's the Rocky World. Yeah.
There's strange music playing.
What kind of party are you going to here?
There's
this weird, crazy acid trip. Like, what if the Tea Company, that last record you played, had a party? That's what it seems like. So the man, the narrator, is then informed that the institution is no longer using the system of soothing that he came to check out. They have implemented a new system invented by someone called Dr. Tarr and someone called Professor Feather.
Oh,
apparently, one incident happened at the institution causing them to make this change, where the patients actually overthrew the caretakers. So that's why they made this change. And so they had to, let's change our system because this system's not working. Just then, loud noises are heard and the hospital staff breaks from their confines, it is revealed that the dinner guests are, in fact, the patients who have recently taken over. As part of the uprising, the inmates treated the staff to tarring and feathering.
Mighty Poe is out of his tree.
Yeah. Oh, the laudanum. Oh, the laudanum. So that's where we get the system of Dr. Tar and Professor Feather.
Lord with that.
So it's the last song on side 180, if you'd be so kind as to drop the needle on it.
Doesn't really
break down the story so much. It kind of takes it as the overarching narrative of the story is sort of like the inmates running the asylum type of thing. So you don't really catch the vibe of it, which is a criticism on this record where it's like you're making a Poe record and it's not dark at all. You know, it's not macabre. It's like, let Slayer
quote
do the
Raven, nevermore, nevermore, nevermore. Quote the Raven, nevermore,
nevermore again.
Oh,
we're all going to hell.
All right, from the album Tales of Mystery and Imagination, 1976. That is, of course, Alan Parsons' project. What do you think of that song?
I'm still high from the record I played, but that kind of helped.
So that was good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad.
That's good in space. That's great, Alan Parsons, though. We were talking about the good stuff. First two records, yeah, and they were. Those are good records. They, you know, that yacht rocky kind of thing, very produced, very precise.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was when they still had a little bop in their step, you know?
Yeah. Kind of cool. Yeah, there's some energy there.
Yeah. And I love the concept. I'm an aggro and Poe freak anyway. So.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk about that guy then.
All right.
So Poe, his mother died when he was just 2 years old. And he was then adopted by a family with the last name Allen. So that's why it's Edgar Allan Poe. So Allen's not his middle name. It's his adopted parents' name. His adopted mother would die when he was 19.
Oh, for the love of God.
So he lost two mothers. His adopted father passed away a few years after.
Lost that. In air quotes. Lost.
His adopted father passed away a few years later, leaving him nothing. So it was like, yeah, there's nothing for you.
Wow.
And then in his mid-20s, he married a 13-year-old girl. He had to petition the state or county.
I mean, how Bill Wyman of you.
And that's, Liz, that's why we were talking off mic. But yeah, the parent of the 13-year-old was not down with that.
Well,
but he had to get a petition and all this. The 13-year-old died 5 or 6 years later.
What's he doing?
Of tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Consumption, they called it back then, which escalated his already heavy drinking. And in October.
More laudanum.
Of 1849, he was found delirious and wandering the streets of Baltimore. And wearing someone else's clothes.
Fantastic.
He was then taken to the hospital where he died a few days later. During his stay in the hospital, he was never coherent. He was rambling and... Oh. He never recovered, A.D. He was never coherent. Rambling.
I understand that the guest registry read, your pals, the tea company. Get well soon, Edgar.
He kept asking for someone named Reynolds. No one knows who Reynolds is.
He was a rapper.
Yay.
So there you go. A short synopsis of Edgar Allan Poe's life. What very mysterious circumstances behind his death. He lost two mothers, a wife.
Wow. He didn't lose. He
dark.
Fucking killed him.
Where did the name Poe come from? If his was
biological Poe. Mother and father were named Poe. I don't know what happened to his biological father. Apparently he split.
So why wasn't he Edgar Poe Allen?
Well, what sounds better?
Okay.
Right?
The name.
He had a manager at 3.
You're going to be
I'm calling him Edgar Poe Allen from
Edgar Poe Allen. All right, AD, what you got?
I've got a shabby classic here.
Oh, good.
I believe this marks the 4th appearance of this band on our little Johnny Gacy of a show.
Uh-oh.
Wow.
And I think this might be the 3rd spin from this very album. This band has released 3 studio albums. I would say 1 that this band qualifies as a shabby favorite. I know you'll agree.
Mm.
And 2, this band, I believe, we have already agreed once or more that it is a bona fide supergroup.
This one's an actually approved, shabby approved supergroup?
Let's double check on that. I brought from Los Angeles, California, the ever so heavy Captain Beyond's.
Oh,
in Captain Beyond's first
supergroup,
album.
Supergroup, yes. I give it a supergroup.
Yes.
Sally, get any applause there for me at all? Finger snaps? Just a pat on the back? Thank you. Right?
Congratulations. I know how much this means to you.
It does. I'm near tears here. what do you got to say about this album that hasn't been said?
Brilliant. Fun. Heavy. For odd meter study.
Right. The cover. It's super group, right? Yeah. You got Atomic Rod Evans. I'm going to give him super names.
Okay.
Atomic Rod Evans.
Atomic Rod was one of your films.
Yes, it was. It was indeed. Actually, it was a snuff film. I played a kind yet murderous Asian dry cleaning magnate, and I had to grow a full Skunk Baxter unit on that one.
Wow.
Yes.
Tough.
It was sweaty under there and all that.
That's the one you did with Ima.
Ima. Yes. Whatever happened to Ima? What was her last name?
Whore.
I was going to go with Hog. I'm a hog.
She might still be in the phone book, right? Oh, God. Okay, so you got Atomic Rod Evans, formerly from Deep Purple. Like, super. That's pretty super.
That's pretty super.
Rhino Man. Reinhardt.
Yes.
Rhino Man, formerly from Iron Butterfly.
They were in Iron Butterfly.
Mecca Lee Dorman. That's a super name. He's got a super name. Mecca.
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 Wow. Mecca Lee.
Mecca or Mecca?
Mecca.
Mecca is in...
Like Mecca Godzilla.
Okay.
Mecca Streisand.
Like,
right? Remember that?
Okay.
Episode of South Park? Robert Smith.
Okay, I missed that one.
Have you seen that one, Liz? Have you seen that one?
Nope.
He's just looking at two blank faces in here, isn't he?
Hey, you guys out there know what I'm talking about. Come on, you. Yeah, right? All right, anyway. And Super Bobby Caldwell.
Yeah, Bobby Caldwell.
Super Bobby.
He was Johnny Winter.
Right, went on to co-found Armageddon with Keith Ralph of the Yardbirds and a couple of the blokes from Steamhammer.
Okay, Steamhammer.
Steamhammer, say that.
Not a supergroup.
You know, I want to hear Liz say that.
Steamhammer.
okay.
All right. We can go forward now. So we talked about them before in the show. So now we all, you know, they've been there, done that. So you guys out there know as much about them as we do in here, right? So we know they made three records. This one, their debut, self-titled, 72. They came out with a follow-up in 73. And their last one dropped, I said, yo.
Wow.
In 77.
A couple years later.
Yeah, 77. So there was a little hiatus. But I learned a little bit about Captain Beyond that we didn't know.
Really?
And a friend of ours is involved. And it's pretty effing cool. I'll get to that in a second. So while I was...
Teaser.
Well, the reason I brought this to begin with is you know, I had a busy week and stuff. And unlike normally what I do is I actually had the Clash and the Tea Company picked out already. So it was just like, you know, I just wanted one good rockin' record. And I'm like, and then we saw Heap last night. I'm like, I want to get something fucking heavy, like real just classic Shab. And I'm like,
yeah.
And then so, you know those Facebook things where you go, they go, what would you look like in a prison suit? Just, you know, add your photo, your profile pic in there and they put a little, you know, or whatever. Or what would you look like bald or with makeup or whatever? Or,
and we'll sell your information to the Russians.
Sure, exactly. So I don't do those things. But recently there was one of those like challenges where somebody nominates you and I got nominated to post my favorite or not favorite, but like some of my most influential albums to post the cover and then, you know, talk about it a little bit. So that one, I'm like, all right, it's about music and records. Oh, fuck, I'm in. So, the first one I posted was this one. They're no in particular order, mm-hmm. You know, whatever. And it's weird because most people got 10, I only got 7.
Nothing else has inspired me.
Just whatever. I just call bullshit on that right away.
Tea Company wasn't in there?
No, not yet. No, well, they would have been. I only got 7.
You
they
might
would
as have well been. Make them number 8.
They would have been cocksucking 9. Let me tell you that right now. So
the cocksucking 9, another one of your films.
Yeah, so it was. And they weren't talking about the 9 people, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah. So, woof. So anyway. I'm thinking, you know, so I put this on there. That was my first one, you know, my first day. You got to put, what, one every day for 7 days. So I put this one on there first, said a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. And it got a little bit, you know, hey, people were chatting about, hey, I love that record, or would never heard of that, or, you know, a couple of people, hey, you know, heard mm-hmm. it on your show and stuff. And, of course, you know Lori, our friend from Lori Morissette from Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
Tongue lady, right? So she, we're all piping in about this, blah, 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 blah. So she says, third album, quoting, she writes in one of the comments, quote, third album is Dawn Explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Third
which
album.
I believe I said Dawn Patrol.
You might have.
Which I think is a Night Ranger album.
It is a Night Ranger album.
God, I'm a dick.
Yeah, that
you know
was
what?
A facts ain't right.
You know what?
Hall of Famer right there.
We should have a penalty for shit like that where you have to actually go buy a Nickelback record.
You should go buy freaking Dawn Patrol.
And we get it on film and like post it and shit. Like, look at Ryan with his fucking Dawn Patrol record. So she goes, no, it's he goes. She goes, third album is Dawn Explosion. Her brother is the singer, Willie D.
On really? Lori's yes. brother?
Yes.
Because we couldn't find much out about that guy.
Well.
And we're two steps from the guy. That's awesome.
We drank shots with her in Seattle, what, two weeks ago?
Yeah, we did.
Three weeks ago, whatever. It's a blur, man. Oh, so cool. Yeah, I'm like, are you fucking kidding? Like, you know, so I'm like, but I'm still playing the first record though, but because it's the one I posted.
That's interesting.
But yeah, man, how cool is that? So that's pretty wild. So anyway, so where is our supergroup now, Ryan? Rhino Man.
Mm-hmm.
Dead.
He passed away. Yes,
cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah.
2012.
Yep.
Lee
Dorman.
Mecca Lee Dorman.
Mecca Lee Dorman.
Mecca Lee Dorman. DNR does not remain.
Hmm.
From quote natural causes, died in his car. Natural causes, and you're in your car.
Was it a car accident?
Well, I think if you go over a cliff, you naturally die. Yes. In your yes. car, and you happen to be in your car.
Hard to argue
when
with
going
that.
Over a 1,000-foot cliff while in flames.
Yeah,
so, but like natural causes. I don't know.
Or something,
it's kind of weird. That's just kind of shady. It's a little cryptic.
Yeah,
if you ask me.
Natural causes. Usually, you're in a hospital bed and you've been there for some time. You're not going down to Safeway and buying some beer.
Yeah, we call bullshit here at Shabby. Yeah. We're going to need more than this. All right. So anyway, okay. So Bobby Caldwell, your pal.
Bobby Caldwell. He's in Florida.
Still rocking balls down there, right?
Yeah.
But what about Rod Evans' post-Captain Beyond story? What about Rod Evans?
I heard
Iron Rod Evans.
I heard he's sort of retired from music and has been for some time. Like, he got into real estate.
After the second Captain Beyond album, Sufficiently Breathless, in 1973, Rod left the music business to become director of respiratory therapy at a Western American hospital up until 1980. At which time he was approached by a management company whose specialty was, quote, questionably reformed bands with well-known names, unquote. The company convinced Rod and two former members of Steppenwolf and a couple of session cats that they could go ahead and be Deep Purple and tour.
You got one original member.
Most shows ended in riots.
Oh, wow. Same with the tea company.
That was kind of called, they ended in naps. and like cookies.
I bet he wasn't around when his friend went over the cliff in a car.
So, right, yeah, natural causes, right? Well, I pushed him off a building and he hit the ground. It's gravity. It's natural. So the actual Deep Purple sues the fuck out of them.
Oh, yes.
In 1980, $672,000. So in 2017 money, that's $1,995,000, nearly $2 million.
Oops.
Evans no longer receives royalties for his first three albums.
Oh, that was part of the deal?
He traded that in.
That sucks.
He shouldn't have.
No.
It's like, I'll owe you. But his lawyer said, you got to pay it. That was an asset. So they put in the asset column.
Oh.
And they said, you have no choice, right?
Wow.
So Rod Evans has not appeared, Ryan, in public since the lawsuit. That's 1980.
Wow.
He has not been seen in public, and his whereabouts are completely unknown to all but very few. In 2015, Deep Purple's former drummer, I'm sorry, in 2015, Deep Purple's drummer Ian Paice put out the statement saying, if anyone knows where Rod is, or even if he is still on the planet, that would be good news. We haven't heard from him since the late 1970s. Nobody seems to know where the hell he is, or even if he is still alive. Not a clue. End quote.
Wow.
Mm.
However, Ryan, your pal, Super Bobby Caldwell, Super Bobby Caldwell.
All right.
I need a theme song. We all need theme songs. Your pal, Super Bobby Caldwell, said in a 2015 interview that he had been in touch with Evans and that Evans was, quote, doing just fine these days and is working in the medical field.
Oh, he's again. Medical field is what it was. Yep.
Right? So, yeah. I guess he's back to the respiratory
thing. But he's never coming back to music.
No, he's done. He's
that
had it
$2
with
that. Million lawsuit kind of soured him.
Yeah.
And it was, that's sad.
Right.
He gets mixed up with the wrong promoter. And you had to sign away your rights to all the Deep Purple stuff from the first 3-4 records? That's awful.
But I bet you something, he's probably making more money than Ian Paice is.
Come on.
If he's in the medical field, he's doing right. So nowadays. Anyway, we're going to play some Captain Beyond. I'm going to play from the very first album, side 2, track 1. It's actually going to be side the first 2 tracks because they combine one sort of an intro thing. So we're going to play 1,000 Days of Yesterday's intro and Frozen Over.
Yes.
From June 1972, Capricorn Records, Captain Beyond produced it. Bobby Caldwell and, I mean, Super Bobby Caldwell and Iron Rod Evans. Supergroup?
Yes.
Captain Beyond. I tripped over my cord.
A thousand days.
right?
Yeah. Oh, it's classic.
Yeah.
Everybody buy that record.
You have to have that record.
I got it.
You right? You have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can't be in here. You can't be in the club.
Wow, Liz. Holy crap.
No, I know she had it, but yeah, anybody else, you can't be in our club if you don't have this record.
Oh, is that
what
it is? You
can't come in, yeah. That was the door slamming.
I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have it.
Right, exactly. Who said that? Who was that? Was that Groucho? Or
probably Groucho.
Fields or you know, one of those guys. Yeah. But no, that was Captain Beyond from their debut self-titled album, June 72. That was 1,000 Days of Yesterday's like intro thing, and then Frozen Over, which, dude, the time changes and like fucking epic in there.
Yeah.
I mean, my God. And Capricorn, that was came out on Capricorn Records, written by Caldwell and Evans. Yeah. Boom.
Sweet. All right. Well done, AD.
Super groove.
So moving on now, I'm going to pull out a record that's going to require us to do an eight ball of cocaine. Luckily, it's in here with the box. So I'll just fish it out of here.
Of course. It came with the record.
Got it from the... It should have come with this record.
It probably did.
Liz knows.
Ma, I reckon you get a quarter fucking gram of good Peruvian cocaine.
Well, let me just come right out with it, AD, because Jens Hellberg, who has put my box together for me tonight, once I told him that, yeah, I chose your selections for episode 166, he goes, oh, cool. I guess AD's not going to be too happy with the Studio 54 record.
What?
A night at Studio 54. Hey, guess what label this is on?
I can't even imagine.
Casablanca, of course.
Of course.
No, not the cocaine.
It
company.
Should have come with cocaine.
Cocaine record company.
Here, have a gander at that
I
little
will.
Beauty.
Oh, what a time that was.
If you ever get to the various artists sections of your record store, you'll find that for $2, and I suggest...
Take me home.
Shares on it.
Yeah.
What else you got on there? You got Chic.
Let Bunk. Let Freak.
You got To Be Real.
What we do? We got Hot Jungle Drum. We got... I don't even know if that's how it goes.
Yeah.
It's called Hot Jungle Drum.
You got
Hot
some
Jungle
it's
Drum.
Got, Donna Summer, of course, is on it because of being a Casablanca artist and all. But yeah, so let's talk about what in the world this is.
This is coke. This is a party. Rod Stewart snorting coke off of
Mick Jagger's cock.
You know, Linda Blair's tits at the bar.
Bitch.
Right? I mean, it's just like, what's going on here?
Now, the track I'm going to play, I'm not going to give it away just yet, AD, but you like the Sugar Hill Gang.
Yeah, I love the Sugar Hill Gang.
One of the, a lot of the musicians that formed that, this was sort of an early incarnation of it.
Sure, Grandmaster Flash.
You can't dismiss it completely.
No, I'm already in. Okay, so hang on. What do you got?
You wouldn't recognize it. So what this record is a joint effort. Much like the tea company. Oh,
like you wouldn't know.
By Casablanca and a marketing firm. I&M is the name of it. I&M.
I'm?
Yeah. It, along with, of course, the owners of Studio 54, which...
Infection and money.
This album was... since the album contained previously released... It's a compilation album, right? It's like a K-Tel album.
Sure.
Kind
of. Yeah.
With a kind of an interesting concept. It contained these previously released hits. I&M, the guys Morris Levy and Ira Pittleman.
Mm-hmm.
Ira Pittleman. Mm-hmm. That's a name.
Yeah.
they're credited as the album's associated producers. Associate producers. And they decided that this album, A Night at Studio 54, wasn't going to get any airplay time because people wouldn't be looking for it in the bins.
Thank God.
As Pittleman later recalled, so in order to promote the album, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in TV and radio advertising to coordinate and coordinated region by region with local record store retailers by tagging them in the spot.
So translation. They bought program directors so much coke.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Or record store owners, like A Night at Studio 54, all the disco hits that you can stomach, and available at Peaches Records.
Here's some cocaine. I play my
and so you'd see like the Peaches Records logo or something.
Yes.
And so they maybe even bought into some of that. Well, it's free advertising for you, so now you got to carry it, and now you got to put it as an end cap.
Hey man,
yeah.
You want a bump? You want a bump? You tired?
You party?
Yeah, party.
You party?
And you want to play my band?
Cocaine!
So that's what this is, and you'll see in the front, if you look at the front, bottom right corner, what's it say?
as seen on television.
That's right. Well, it paid off, AD. This album is certified gold and reached number 21 on the Billboard charts.
One
of the interesting concepts, well, this is 1979, right in the middle of it all.
You know who's on there? Michael Zager.
Who's Michael Zager?
Zager and Evans. In the year 2525.
That can't be the same guy, is
Michael
it?
Michael Zager. Who's named Zager?
Michael Zager.
We got to fact check
three
that.
Three dudes named Zager, ever.
So what this is four album sides worth of songs that were played at Studio 54, the legendary New York club discotheque. And they're all mixed together like a DJ would mix them together by actual Studio 54 DJs. Mark Paul Simon.
You're killing me, Smalls.
And Roy Thoad. For continuous playing, reminiscent of a DJ set right there on a Saturday night in the middle of Manhattan.
Pile of cocaine between you and Jack Nicholson and whoever.
Oh, yes.
Like a starlet at the time.
Yes.
Bianca Suzanne Jagger. Summers, yeah. Out there.
Suzanne
whatever.
Summers. Located at
254. Liza Minnelli.
Located at 254.
No, she's a wreck by then.
254 West 54th Street between 8th Avenue and Broadway in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Which...
Guys, I finally made it to New York City!
Shut the fuck up!
I missed that one. It's been a while. Oh, good to have her back. And him.
Yeah.
It was founded and opened by Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager in 1977. Of course, it's. I think we all kind of know this, that velvet rope stuff was sort of invented by Steve Rubell, where... Even Henry Winkler, the Fonz, could not get into Studio 54 because he wasn't wearing cool enough clothes.
Hey, they don't like my beach shorts.
And Chic, who's featured, ironically, as side one, track one, the song was written because Nile Rodgers could not get into Studio 54.
Wow.
Les Freak. Wow. Yeah, Les Freak. It started out as... Aw, fuck you. Because they left Steve Rubell on the Velvet Rope and just went back to their studio in Manhattan and made that song. And it kicks off this album, which is great.
Poetic justice.
The whole idea.
Edgar Allan Poetic Justice.
The whole. Wow, nice. Yeah. The whole idea was Steve Rubell would just create. What you want to do is you want to have the coolest people in town at your club, right? So you want people cooler than you. And so. By him turning people down like a Fonzie, you know, it's like, wow, Fonzie couldn't even get in. Imagine if
People
we
Magazine,
get in.
Yeah.
Imagine if we get in there and Fonzie couldn't
We're
even
cooler
fucking
than
get
Fonzie.
In.
Fonzie.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but all good things must come to an end, AD.
No, they did a movie on it. Have you seen the?
I've never seen the movie. No, isn't it Mike Myers as Steve Rubell?
As Steve Rubell, I've seen
it. I think it is, yeah. It's actually good flick.
Is it good?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
What they were doing was, well, first of all, they had problems with the liquor license. They never really got an official liquor license from the state of New York.
Well, they never really got a cocaine license either, Ryan. Yeah.
They did like a caterer's license.
They didn't have a sex in the bathroom or in the kitchen
or animal
license either. Yeah.
There was some kind of loophole where they found you can just get a caterer's license and still sell booze, but for one day. They had to keep getting it.
God.
And then once they got that solved, then Steve Rubell shot his mouth off on some radio show and said, the club is doing so well, we made $7 million this year.
And they didn't have
IRS.
To pay taxes.
And the IRS said, you did what now?
He went to work he went to work the next day and it was chained.
Right. They're like, we need to see what you're doing. And of course, both Steve and Ian were skimming off the top and to the tune of $2.5 million, the cash that came into the bar, they just took it.
And there was so much blow going in and out of there, too, because what do you do with cash? What's untraceable?
Cash.
Yeah, and oops, Coke.
Coke.
And they hid so many drugs and so much cash. They were hiding the cash and receipts in the club.
In Cher.
The club, in the walls.
In Cher. In Cher.
Yeah.
In Grace Jones.
Oh, my God. Yeah, right.
So they did some serious time for it.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what the deal is here, but I read that in January 2017, Ian Schrager received a full, complete, and unconditional presidential pardon from Barack Obama.
Because you know why?
Did he buy coke from
He probably did. What the fuck?
Yeah. That's
probably
weird.
Smoked pot with him.
So
that's fucking funny.
Barack, man.
So let's get to what I have to play. I have to play this.
Oh, God. What do you
Jens, we're still pals. It's Ryan I'm going to fight.
If you see, AD, if you look on side four, Musique is the name of the band.
Oh, no. Freak out.
No.
Musique.
Musique, as in Musique.
Oh, in the bush.
Do you know the song?
In the bush.
As in push in the bush.
Oh, that one? Yeah. No. Oh, no.
It's a low budget.
I wouldn't have known that.
It's a low budget project created by producer Patrick Adams, Harlem's own Patrick Adams, who would go on to produce tons of records. This was sort of his foray into the industry. He worked with everyone from Gladys Knight to Coolio in his career. Musicians included here are Skip McDonald and Doug Wimbish, who were among...
Doug Wimbish, a great bass player.
He's playing bass on this. Among the musicians later responsible for much of the background music or the backing band work for Sugar Hill Records.
Ooh. So that's the band mm-hmm. behind Grandmaster Flash.
Yes, that's who this is.
Get
that's why
the
I picked
fuck.
It.
Wimbish is behind it. Dude, yeah. I met him at NAMM 2 years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, I got a picture with him.
Nice.
Yeah,
name
dude.
Dropper.
No, but I'm saying that's fucking trippy that you fucking cunts. No, but I'm saying that's exciting. That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had a rap to him.
Yeah, of the three records.
You didn't catch that. I would have rapped to him.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I can rap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, God, fuckers.
Of the three records I brought, I listened to. Of course, when we picked these records, I listened to them. Maybe even starting Sunday and into Monday. This one made me smile the most. I freaking loved it. It is that scene. It is everything. The hedonism, the cocaine. Everything about it. It's fun. It's so fun all the way through the damn record.
So we have a disco ball here. There's no doubt about that.
Yes.
We're all looking at it. Mm-hmm. Should we put on our see-through puffy blouses and roller skates and
go right ahead.
Get uh-huh. this fucking thing going?
Look, Grace Jones is literally in the parking lot waiting for the song to start. So she can come in.
No. Grace ain't getting in here.
Does she not have Captain Beyond?
No, she's not getting in here. She's not Captain Beyond.
Okay,
keep her waiting out there.
I'll text her and tell her to go to the
record
store.
You know what? Let's get the Fonz in here. I bet he's got Captain Beyond.
He doesn't wear cool enough clothes.
You know what? He's got Captain Beyond. He can come in.
We'll see about that. All right, In the Bush by Musique from A Night at Studio 54, June 1979 on Casablanca Records with partnership from I&M and blah, 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 the owners of Studio 54.
Push in the bush. Push in the bush. Push in the bush. Push in the bush.
And the DJ mixed it right into Dan Hartman's song, Instant Replay, I believe, there.
I'm itching. I have a rash.
Because you need some Coke?
Yeah, I need some Coke. I'm jonesing, if you will. It's funny, my Coke dealer was Mike Myers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Steve Rebell.
Right.
Liz, can you turn the house down a little bit? I feel like I'm echoing.
Turn the house down.
Turn the house down. Yeah, we had a cranked in here, obviously, and the disco ball was going. So there you go. Was the kick drum loud enough for you there? Or?
Never. Never. Never loud enough.
There is more four on the floor kick drum on this record than any record ever made ever.
You know, I guess the thing about this, when you go down the track listing, is that it isn't the typical, when you think disco and that era. You know,
he was snorting coke.
It's the typical, you know, Jungle Boogie and the radio hits and things like that. These were the club hits. And really, when you think about it, that was the first time sort of club music became club music. Like, okay, it doesn't matter what they're playing on the airwaves. In the clubs, they're playing this. And I think that was the game changer in that department.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, and that's what makes this record good, because there's hits on here, but it's also really full of underground club stuff.
Right.
Like that. Like this song that we just heard, In the Bush by Musique, was banned on several radio stations, as you could probably imagine.
Yeah.
But still managed to make it to 54. And it also landed really high on the dance charts.
Right, see?
Like top five, because the DJs were playing it.
Right.
You know, so it was interesting, you know.
It was a different...
another shift in the music business.
It wasn't the usual suspects, I guess, on this record, which made it great.
Right, yeah. And it's a fun record. It's a $2 record.
I bet it's fun.
If you ever want to turn your house into a disco, into Studio 54...
I don't hate disco as much as you think I do.
I know you don't.
I got that drop.
I know you don't. Yeah, I actually... Because you said it while it started playing, and you got your headphones on, and you're listening, and you said, right? See... This is real dudes playing this music.
That's the difference, right?
Every person is a real dude.
It's not a machine. That's a band playing that, and they're goddamn tight.
Right. Yeah.
They're freaking tight, man, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's great. And that's the same band that became Grandmaster Flash, so I'm in.
There you go. Yeah. Musique.
Real music. That doesn't matter. Just as long as it's real, right?
Makes a difference.
So, well, there we go. Episode 166 dances its way out of your iPod or your Android, wherever you find us.
Or your disco
ball.
And
it's doing a lot of coke on the way out.
Oh, man.
Cocaine!
Well, the mystery boxes are empty, AD.
Yeah, I think
so. Well, let's say, before I say all that bullshit... let's say goodnight to Liz Morgan and thank her for running the controls tonight and Uriah Heep tickets.
You're welcome.
And she's brought with her that cantankerous old bag of bolts who is now doing a line of coke off of Grace Jones's
nether regions.
Forehead.
Netherlands.
Her real estate. Off of Grace Jones's real estate.
That is Sal 5000.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Oh, I'd do some terrible things.
Grace. Well, okay. Well, the mystery boxes are empty, so I'm going to leave this rubber room so the crew can hose it off. Before I go, I'll say goodnight to a man who's hanging out in the bathroom with 20 hookers in a champagne jacuzzi with the door locked. True story. Robert De Niro at Studio 54.
Excellent.
A.D. Adams.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, sometimes party can be so sad, but not here. Nope, and not now. We're busting out of here like Katy Perry's brand new boobs. So before we can cause a pileup at the front door, let's get the air clear in here, allowing the billowing clouds of purple nurple kush to flow down into the dank, sunny slope sky. And I'd like to thank my partner, pal, and co-host, Mr. Ryan McKay, for another great show. And I'd like to wish all who are listening... a swan's tattoo.
Those get worse and worse and worse.
Oh, I work for that.
That is a sucker punch to the gonads.
Yeah, I apologize for all that. Best I could do.
A portion of the Shabby Road Record Show is fearlessly brought to you by those crazy bastards at nameonanything.com. Use the promo code SHABBY at checkout and save 10% on your order. nameonanything.com.